Revenue Committee, and welcome everybody today. And I want to start actually with the work session. Is Elizabeth here? Can we get Elizabeth? I'd like to, who does 2047? Who's is that? Yeah, come on up.
Baseball trade.
We will start, I think we can knock out a couple of work sessions quickly here, and then we'll spend the rest of our time on the hearing on House Bill 2279. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2047. Dick, we don't have any amendments on this?
No.
Okay. It's the fair bill.
It's the fair bill, right, which allocates lottery money, 1.2% of the net proceeds of the lottery. And the first $3.6 million of that goes to the county fair account, and any excess goes to the Oregon county fair account. Remember our distinction.
We do. John McCulley, why don't you come on up and give us what you have in mind for the bill today?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley, representing Oregon Fairs Association. We would request that the committee send this bill down to the Ways and Means Committee. Obviously, it has a pretty major fiscal impact and needs to be evaluated down there. When the bill was heard, Representative Johnson testified before you about an accountability bill that she was introducing, and that is House Bill 3905. That bill was heard yesterday by the House Agriculture and Forestry Committee and was also approved to go down to the Ways and Means Committee. There was another bill yesterday in House Agriculture and Forestry, House Bill 3530, introduced by Representative Butler, which deals with a similar issue of allocating lottery funds to county fairs. That bill also was sent to Ways and Means yesterday by the House Ag and Forestry Committee. So we would respectfully request that House Bill 2047 be sent down to the Ways and Means Committee so they can all be evaluated together in that budgetary process.
Anybody want to ask John anything? If the committee is so inclined, the motion would be to move House Bill 2047 to the floor with a due pass, and that the bill be referred to the joint Ways and Means Committee. That would be the motion, then the bill will go not to the floor, but instead to Ways and Means. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I would so move.
Okay, Representative Carlson moves House Bill 2047 to the with a due pass to the floor, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Is there discussion on the motion? Representative Williams? That's in the motion.
Mr. Chair, I'm certainly willing to move this bill down to the Ways and Means Committee, and I don't have any objection that it go down there and attempt to find its place like all the other bills. I'm a little hesitant to place on it the due pass recommendation because I have some serious concerns, I guess, about in our current situation the amount of revenue that this would generate, this percentage would generate as compared to some of the other challenges that we face. So I'm willing to certainly vote for moving it to the Ways and Means Committee where the proponents can sort of fight it out in that process down there. But I am hesitant to support it with a due pass recommendation because I think it sends a signal that we're supportive of the process that's here, and I'm a little hesitant of that.
Thank you. Before I ask Representative Carlson if she would amend her motion, let me take not a vote but a poll to see what the support is on the committee for the motion with the due pass recommendation in it. Either a nod of the head or a thumbs up. One, two, three, four,
That's a question, Dick.
Okay.
Let me ask a question.
Sure you can.
I'm new to this process.
Mm-hmm.
You're not new anymore. You've been here almost 3 months.
I still feel like a rookie.
You're under term limits, you're a senior member now.
It's the way through your three terms.
Point of clarification, then. We can send it without recommendation.
Yes, we can send it without recommendation.
That's all I wanted to know. Yes. Thank you.
We can send it without recommendation. It will require Representative Carlson to amend her motion. I counted four.
Now, you have the votes, obviously.
No, I don't have the votes. We need five.
Oh, do you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Representative Carlson, what's your pleasure?
Well, nobody that was on
the stand line can come
with them. In some ways, it's sort of symbolic, I guess. I mean, it's going to get down there, and it's going to fight its way out, and I'm sure that Mr. McCulley and the affairs people would prefer to see it go down with a due pass, and I can understand why that is. And maybe just having this conversation here and putting sort of our concerns on the record will be sufficient enough that they'll acknowledge that when they get it down into the Ways and Means process. But if we were voting straight up or down today on whether this bill should go out with the amount of money that it's currently generating in our current environment, I couldn't recommend it with a due pass. So it's a little disingenuous to let it flow down to Ways and Means and let them understand that I've got that hesitancy without at least putting that on the record. And I think we do somewhat of a disservice to the Ways and Means Committee by doing so.
Representative Hanson.
A little bit of deja vu here for me. We just had this very similar issue at the Environment Committee where a measure that I cared very much about and so does Representative Williams about creating a new state park in Washington County. The issue
that's what this is all about.
Sending this to
No, it's not actually. but it could be. It'd be a great fair site, John.
And both were the issues, you know, everybody supports county parks, everybody supports a new state park, and but after much arguing or civil debate, I should say, we voted not to do a due pass. And so I think that was probably fair, and this would be fair to not take a position on that.
Well, we are at four, and now we have Representative Beck, who's not indicated how he's going to would vote.
Just let me clarify, is the amount of money that we're talking about, it's about $4 million for 0103, is that right, out of the lottery? And also we heard during the last hearing that the fiscal impact statement was not written quite correctly, but it doesn't actually offset the three programs that are listed, that they're actually dollars above and beyond the ones that are listed, is that right?
That's correct.
Remember,
the fiscal statement had applied the 1.2% against the what they calculated to be the unobligated funds from lottery net proceeds, and that's not what the bill says. The bill says 1.2% of net lottery proceeds, and you get that money only to the extent it exceeds the unobligated balance.
And I guess, Mr. Chair, that, I mean, given $4 million is a lot of money, yes, but we've just made some decisions in this group that have affected counties and cities and school districts by property tax exemptions at a much higher level than that and not even blinked about it. And so here we're dealing with county fairs, and I guess, you know, I'm trying to figure out where the distinction is, why somehow those have a due pass recommendation if you give a tax credit to different people and then they are allowed to offset property taxes that affect county mental health services, county public health services, school districts, juvenile departments, community corrections, and yet all of a sudden we have this great conscience now that we're developing over $4 million for county fairs. So I guess that's sort of my question that I'm raising.
If I may, the sum of the numbers involved is $5.3 million. So it's 3.6 to the county fair fund and 1.7 to the Oregon County Fair Fund.
But if I could just clarify,
yes,
that would be out of lottery money that goes to a number of various purposes, including the Economic Development Department and different programs in that department and other types of regional strategies and things that are possible for us to determine whether or not those are our priorities as well.
Representative Beck, let me bring you up to speed. The motion is to move House Bill 2047 to the floor with a due pass
and
that the bill be referred to Ways and Means. So the debate really at this point is on the due pass language, whether to attach the due pass to the motion or whether to pass it to Ways and Means to the floor through Ways and Means without recommendation. That is the question. There are four votes based on my poll, and I haven't done the done any of the crosstabs, but based on my poll, there are four votes to support it with a do-pass recommendation, and then you walk in.
I'm not inclined to support the bill or any statutory obligation of lottery funds. I think the number of people have gone to the ballot and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to get a portion of the lottery dedicated via the Constitution, rightly or wrongly. I think if we're going to start dedicating portions of the lottery, it ought to be done through the Constitution and not in statute.
Okay.
I'm a no.
I would like to amend my motion.
But
it was a valiant effort.
It was a good effort.
Okay.
And a worthy effort. I'm not even sure I'll bother asking Representative.
So I would move House Bill 2047 to the floor without recommendation, with a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
And that the bill be referred to
the Committee on Ways and Means.
Just before I take that motion, as long as we've got her, Representative Kefouri, let me bring you up to speed.
Okay.
We have before us House Bill 2047, which is the county fairs bill.
Okay.
The motion that Representative Carlson made originally was to move the bill to the floor with a due pass and that it be referred to Ways and Means. We amassed a total of four votes based on my polling to support that motion, the concern being the do-pass part of the recommendation. And then Representative Beck walked in and indicated he could not help get that fifth vote for the do-pass. And I guess before I take her amended motion to delete the do-pass portion of the motion, I would ask you if you would be inclined to support it with the do-pass recommendation.
I would be more comfortable supporting the amended.
That is what I needed to hear. Then the amended motion before us is to move the bill, House Bill 2047, without recommendation, to the floor, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Now, is there further discussion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Page.
Aye.
Beck.
No.
Brown.
Aye.
Pat.
Aye.
Williams.
Aye.
Webb.
Aye.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Kefouri.
Aye.
Chair Shatterly.
Aye. The motion carries. The bill will go to Ways and Means. That will conclude our work session on House Bill 2047. Let's pick up quickly with House Bill 2033. And we do have an amendment on that. Lizbeth, if you could. Well, she's coming up. Gary Conklin, are you here? Yeah, come on up. And maybe John. Whoops.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2033, you have two amendments. You have a -3 and you have a -4. Now, with the -3, what this is clarifying. Vice Chair Carlson had a point of clarification that needed to be made under subsection 3. And so this is really taking your -2 and just clarifying it on the second page when we're talking about the credit and where exactly the machinery and equipment is to be located. So this does nothing as far as changing the substance. It makes it easier to read and clarifies it. And then with your -4 amendment, this is deleting the section 7 of the bill, which was the subject of some conversation at your last meeting. So basically with your -4 amendment, this is going to keep it so that the revenue impact is just a state funded income tax credit, which is estimated at roughly $509,775 for the 2002-03, and then for the 2003-05 biennium, $1.48 million. So basically with the Section 7, it was the issue of what is farm use machinery and equipment, and that was some confusing. That just that language itself was a little confusing for some counties, questioning whether or not that would be something that would be taken off the roll, or if it was just something that they were going to have to reclassify it and use different change property ratios And after looking at a survey of approximately 20 different counties, Department of Revenue gave me some data on that. And that basically, when you're looking at industrial and farm use change property ratios, you do see quite a difference. And the CPR for industrial on average was about 0.94 versus farm use, which is about 0.8. So this could have an effect of changing these accounts that originally are industrial, and then we could change to this farm use machinery and equipment if they qualify for the tax credit. And another issue, which is also in Section 7, is removing the income approach to valuing these industrial processing accounts. So by eliminating that section, you would also be eliminating that uncertainty that would arise from having to change these accounts and their approach of valuation.
Okay. Gary Conklin, do you want to address these?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Gary Conklin, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. The Dash 3 amendments, we support. This is language in the main that we've worked out with the department to make it clear who would qualify and how to understand the qualification, as well as for the taxpayer to file using, in general, readily available information. And it, as your staff has indicated, contains the, I think, the cleanup of language that Representative Carlson recommended. So we support the Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 4 amendment is a deletion of Section 7 and, I believe, also Section 8, which relates to Section 7. And this issue arose, as I indicated in my previous testimony before the committee, in the work group relating to principally classifying, being able to track the kind of machinery and equipment that would be eligible for the credit. But the offline conversation with the department and others would suggest that that classification system may not be as useful, or at least as completely faithful to the task as we'd hoped, and to find the better part of valor here, which is to find a secure place to stand. I'd rather not have a local property tax revenue impact nor any uncertainty. As you know, the history of this legislation has been slippery enough. So I would rather deal with where the base agreement was among the work group with our local government partners. And so the Dash 4 amendment takes out in its entirety Section 7 and 8.
Okay. John Phillips, anything to add?
No, I think that
okay.
Covers it well.
Any questions from the committee members? We don't have a Dash 1. So all we need is a Dash 3 and a Dash 4 to move the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the Dash 1 and the Dash 2 were actually earlier iterations
right.
of what
right.
now is the Dash 3.
Right. That's what I wanted to make clear so we didn't leave anything off. Okay. Yes, Representative Williams.
I move the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2033.
Thank you. Representative Williams moves the adoption of the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2033. Is there any discussion? I've just been looking at these. They seem to address that grammatical issue about the land, the machinery being contiguous. So that,
yeah.
that's what we're after there. Any objection to the motion to incorporate the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 2033? If not, they're in. Representative Williams.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 2033.
Representative Williams moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2033. Is there any discussion on that? Again, this clarifies that we were intending not to have a local revenue impact in this whole scheme, and that seems to clarify that issue. Is there any further discussion, any objection to the Dash 4 amendments? If not, we are in. Representative Williams?
Mr. Chairman, I would move House Bill 2033 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves House Bill 2033. As amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Representative Witt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, I hope finally we have a solution here that's going to work to address this need relative to agriculture in Oregon. in terms of providing an opportunity for those in agriculture to add value added to their product on their property. So I think particularly when you look at what's happened to agricultural commodity prices, the farming sector in Oregon's been very, very hurt over the last 4, 5, 6 years. I don't know if there's any insight to that. But I think if this solution finally works and we get this all the way through the process and get the governor's signature, this is a nice opportunity for those who can add value on the farm with their farm processing to a final product. So I think this is a very good measure, and I know it's been a long time getting here, but it's good to see it here.
Case in point, one of those things where sometimes it just takes a few sessions to get the concept through. Congratulate the folks that worked on the work group to come up with a creative way to do it. Representative Bates.
Just a comment also, this is something that's going to impact my district. We have a small but thriving industry in winemaking now, and when I talk to the farmers in my district, many of those people who have been farming with other methods of farming, whether it be sheep or cattle or row crops, are not making it anymore. And the one group that does seem to be thriving and is trying to grow is the wine industry. So this is something that should help them a great deal. I'm in favor of it. I still have some concerns that we're still passing out bills that reduce revenue, but I think this is one that will ultimately have an alternative effect and actually raise revenue as our industry thrives. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
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 Brown.
Aye.
Half.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Webb.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2033 goes to the floor with as amended, with a due pass recommendation. Do I have a volunteer for a carrier? Huh? Oh, it's your. You got it.
I'm glad. It's just a rookie needs to practice.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
I'll be seeing that 10 years from now.
I think there is a rule in the House that no open wine bottles on the floor.
I'll be handing out a case to everybody. Rose Belly Merlot. You know, it's about $40 a bottle. You guys will take it, right? Huh? Well, we can't accept that we're in session.
A day like we had on the
premise. Sorry, can't happen. I'm sorry.
All right. With that, let me get my committee back under control. Geez, almost lost in the first bill and then lost at the end of the second. Close the work session on House Bill 2033, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2279. Ed, is that you? I mean, I know it's you, but...
Not doing me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2279 requires that political subdivisions imposing income taxes or taxes measured by income use the taxable income base defined in Oregon statute, including apportionment rules in ORS Chapter 314. This would become effective beginning the 2002 tax year and would seem to affect most directly the Multnomah County business income tax and the City of Portland business license fee.
Okay. Representative Witt, did you want to speak to this before we bring up the witnesses?
Yeah, I would briefly, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I introduced this bill at the request of a number of business owners in Multnomah County and in Portland who have persuaded me that there are certain provisions in the business income tax in Multnomah County and the City of Portland, which are disadvantageous to smaller businesses. And I've looked at the information they've given me, and I've been convinced that the way that the city and the county are currently determining what tax is subject, or what income is subject to tax, creates creates a bias against smaller businesses. And I've met with the city about this, and we've discussed it, and I've made some other suggestions to them, but this bill would require them to look at business income, particularly from corporations, the same way the state of Oregon or the federal government does, which is, I think, as you listen to the testimony today, you'll see that city and the county don't do that. And because of that, smaller businesses tend to pay a very, very high portion of their income in tax, typically much higher than a larger corporation. And I think this bill would address that issue.
Okay. Let me bring up the requester of the bill, Mr. Barker, if you want to come forward.
I'm sorry, Butler? Oh, I should look at the bill. Yeah, Butler, I'm not on the bill. Mr. Butler. Sorry about that. Please proceed.
Chairman Shirley and distinguished members of the committee, I'm Robert Butler. I reside at 226 Southwest Parkside Drive in Portland, Oregon. And I'd like to discuss with you the need for this level playing field for all employers throughout the state of Oregon. And to begin with, I'd like to say that this bill is intended to be revenue neutral. It is intended not to have any financial impact upon the state of Oregon. It is a matter of creating some standards such that all local governments now using or intending to use in the future some benchmarks and some standards such that we don't become inundated with a barrage of several local governments creating very difficult and comprehensive codes, hampering commerce in the state of Oregon and making doing business in Oregon much more expensive. And I hope you agree with me that in times like this, after Proposition 5 and many other things that are hitting us, that there is a lot of pressure by local governments to create new revenue sources. And I think all of us have seen the almost frenzy for this need in development impact fees that are kind of hitting the state like a wave, a giant wave. And I noticed that last year, in between sessions, that the city of Portland, Multnomah County, was kind of lobbying for Clackamas County and Washington County to get into the business income tax business and create a more of a parity in the Upper Valley in the business community. So that would have quite an impact on the state of Oregon, and helps me realize a greater need for standards across the state that local governments will adhere to, at least as guidelines to construct any taxes. And I want to emphasize not only taxes, but fees and licenses, which are basically an income tax in effect, that those such codes would parallel as much as reasonably possible the Oregon Department of Revenue. And I'm sure it's more obvious to you perhaps than me that all the businesses in Oregon understand the Oregon Department of Revenue codes, and so they'd be comfortable with these new revenue sources from local governments and would fit well into their accounting systems to have those similarities. Now, I would like to say that although this is mainly about making Oregon a better place to do business and removing current impediments and future impediments, I want to say that it's amazing how creative Portland and Multnomah County has become in their tax code. And I will probably dwell on it maybe extensively, but this creativity I would like you to consider as something that has made it very possible, and I will even offer probable, that other local governments will be tempted to be as equally creative and challenging in their tax codes in such a way as to impede commerce in, throughout the state of Oregon. The most creative thing about the Portland tax code in Multnomah County, and really Portland is a fee, they choose to call it a fee, although they're very clear it's income-driven and net income-driven, is that it starts out with basically a format of the Oregon Department of Revenue, and basically you're filling in forms, you're filling out your local government forms, like BIT TAS and license fee, using your information from your state return. And but unfortunately, there is a pretty big departure, and it happens rather quickly. And if you care to, I'll show you where I'm at. I happen to have, perhaps in your hands by now, about a 6-page document with my name on the bottom, Robert Butler. And about the last, second to the last page, it shows on the form that you file with your business, state for City of Portland and Multnomah County, it shows there is an unusual request in there, and it's on number line 3. It wants to know how many of those people receiving compensation for work own more than 5% ownership of the company or entity or corporation or sole proprietorship. Wants to know how many. Then down on line 6, it says, okay, now we want you to do some math. Now that you've gone through all your employees and asked the question, does this employee who's received compensation own 5% or more of your ownership of your company? Now they ask you, how much of that compensation was over $53,000? So then you go through and you do that math. And what you do with that math when you get done is you treat it as additional profit. Now I call this phantom profit. And so if you are inclined to maybe turn to page 2 of the chart of my handout, there is a chart there that distinguishes why this is a prejudice against small employers. Remember that I just said that it asks the question, which employee compensations were from people that own over 5% of interest? Well, that test right there, that question right there, essentially divides small business from big business. Because in big business, rarely does an employee earning compensation own over 5% of the company. So really, the question is meant, now let's look at small employers and tax them a phantom tax. And so the effect, if you don't mind looking at the chart or me mentioning what the chart says, is that the large employer gets all of his deductions. He's basically in the same tax bracket as shown on the charts in the tax provisions, which is for Portland and Multnomah County a total of 3.65%. 2.2% for the city and 1.25% for the county. So that totals 3.65%. Okay, well that large corporation basically is paying that tax, 3.65%. But remember, our small employer, let's say he has the same net operating income of $25,000. That small employer, if he had say $100,000 of employee compensation to one of the owners, maybe the sole proprietor, he would have to add back some money to his profit, phantom profit. That phantom profit is his $100,000 less the $53,000 allowed. So he has to add back $43,000, $47,000 of phantom tax. And so suddenly his tax jumps up to $72,000 reportable net income, whereas the big corporation, he's still down at the 25. And this equates to a small employer tax bracket of an effectively 10.5%, nearly triple that of the large employer. Now, I might note that this $53,000 a year lid works out to about $26 an hour. 2,000 hours a year is times $26 is the $53,000. Now, this lid was put in effect about 20 years ago, and it was $50,000. Since then and now, almost 20 years, it's gone up from $50,000 to $53,000. Had it kept up with cost of living, it would have to be over $165,000. $165,000. If we were to buy into this kind of creativity being good for Oregon and local governments being this creative. But that's not so much the issue, the fact that it hasn't kept up. The issue is that this is kind of a bizarre thing to ask an employer to do. Go through all of your employees, figure out which ones are owners, subtract out income, add it back as phantom profit, and pay a tax. That's bizarre, but it's even more bizarre, and I hope you don't mind if I explain why. This happened about 20 years ago as a very cumbersome way to solve a problem. And the problem it was trying to solve is, let's stop cheating. Let's stop the cheaters. And what they were trying to do was decide on a income that was so high that was obviously a juggling of the books, as opposed to honest reporting of your revenues and expenses. And the theory was is that if someone made so much money, it was clear that they were cheating. They were cheating. So what we will do is that we will tax them as cheaters. And that's how the $50,000 worked. Now, why would someone cheat? Well, in reality, they probably wouldn't, but they could. Someone could cheat because since they can determine as a controlling owner how much money they pay themselves, at the end of the year, they take out their pencil and decide what their income is, and they pay themselves enough income that there's no profit to the company. Now, you probably know that's called bonusing out. So that's cheating in that sense. But, you know, is this something likely to happen? Or is this something like the tail wagging the dog? In other words, because you got to play with your federal return, you got to play with your state return, you have to play all your returns to do this juggling. So I mean, it's a little surprising that the city and the county would even worry about this, but let's say they should. And then, but is this the solution? I mean, what kind of a solution is this? Let me give you an example. Let's say, if you don't mind, let's say we have two companies, and one of them is kind of a small company, but they're cheaters. And it's a mom-and-pop store, and mom really worked only worth $15,000 a year, and dad only worked $15,000 a year. But you know what? When they're filling out the tax return, it was only $30,000. They noticed they had $10,000 profit. So they might cheat and just give themselves a bigger W-2 and say, well, now it's $40,000. There's no profit. I don't owe the city or the county any money. But here's the problem. This approach doesn't solve the problem because these people are only $40,000. Remember, the limit's $50,000. So these cheaters get away, don't they? They get away with it. Well, what kind of a solution is this? But this gets worse. What about the honest person, the doctor, or just the hardworking small businessman who really did earn $100,000? And he worked 7 days a week, you know, 3,000 hour a year, 7 days a week, just worked his little heart out. And he honestly reported $100,000. Well, guess what? He's a cheater now. He's a cheater, isn't he? Because he gets taxed for that. Now, that's presumption of what? Presumption of fraud. Tax fraud, isn't it? Presumption of tax fraud. What's your defense? There is no defense, is there? There's nothing they can do about it, is there? Okay. So I'd like to suggest to you that this is totally bizarre, bizarre code. Now, I don't think it's our problem, your problem, to worry about Portland, because your interest is Oregon. I mention this because this can happen, and it's been happening for years. It's been happening for years, and it'll happen again and again. And now is the time to fix it. Of course, we would be terribly pleased if you were to fix it for the whole state, because then it would fix our problem too. Okay? Now, if I might move on, hopefully a little faster for you. I'd like to read three sentences to you. And the reason I do this, because, first of all, I want to, if you don't mind, this is an old problem. This is an old problem. This report was prepared 10 years ago at the request of the city of review our city income tax licensing fee. And this report 10 years ago said, this isn't fair. There are problems there. And if you care to jump back to the last page, you'll see some of the conclusions of that. And I'll get to one of those points later. But it said very clearly the $50,000 is obviously bizarre 10 years ago. They didn't use the word bizarre, but obviously wrong 10 years ago. And look at it now. So here's the letter. So this is 10 years ago. City Council was where. Just 5 years ago, here's a letter to Vera Katz from a regional manager, director of a securities company, Pacific Crest Securities. Now, I'll just jump to the meat of it, if you don't mind. To Dear Mayor Katz, last year the Business Journal reported that Louisiana Pacific paid its president $12.2 million. In compensation, U.S. Bancorp paid its CEO $1.1 million, and Pacific Corp paid its CEO $1.4 million. Underline, every dollar compensation paid to these executives was deductible by these companies in computing their city and county taxes. But a company whose executives own over 5% of the company's stock, by definition a small and medium-sized business, can only deduct the first $50,000 of each executive's compensation. I just mentioned that because this has been around for quite a while, and really, I hopefully it will get some more attention. Now, one of the pages in here, and you can see I'm running out of pages, and I'm probably your patience, and I apologize for that, is a letter from Commissioner Saltzman. And Commissioner Saltzman was sensitive to this, at least back in 1995, but he said in this letter, if we are to change this owner's compensation lid up to where it belongs, then 10 years ago or 5 years ago, to $125,000, we'll lose almost $4 million of county money. So my point is that this approach to taxing small employers with this prejudice is big money for the county and the city. Big money. And I'm suggesting that perhaps that's why they're doing it, because they want the money. Okay? So I think I've covered the main points, and now there's a technical point. Now, I suspect that people from the city and the county who I know are very dedicated people. I probably work very hard, and I have a lot of respect for them. And they are trying to please, of course, their commissioners and mayor and chairman. But even though that may be the case, I want to suggest that they're going to bring up some issues that I need to address in advance, and I'll try and cover them quickly. I'm going to say, first of all, that this report was very comprehensive, although it didn't say that this is a frivolous thing to do to small employers, is to ask them how much money they made over $53,000 or $50,000 at the time, it was a genuine attempt. And it's clear that they were unhappy 10 years ago. But there is one thing that is on the last page here, and I suspect it might be made a point of, so I'll cover it now, and it's the last point. And that is what is called the four-factor test. I hope you know what the four-factor test is. I didn't know what it was, but you probably know that when a local tax is administered, that you can prorate the amount of tax that's in your area and only pay tax, prorate the net income of the tax associated with the particular government that you're in, local government, you're in, that's called apportionment, isn't it? So you get to apportion it. You don't pay the tax for all the net profit you made in the world or in the United States or throughout the state of Oregon. You get to apportion it for the local government that you're in. Now, you probably know that the state of Oregon has what's called the four-factor test, which is a test that kind of apportions things, taking in consideration how much of your sales were in the state of Oregon, how many employees you had in the state of Oregon, and what your assets were in terms of equipment, machinery, and plant in the state of Oregon. And it's a kind of a balancing act to make this thing fairer. And I just want to mention that this committee that worked so hard on this, and to no avail till hopefully today, I shouldn't say it that way, but maybe to better avail today, reviewed this matter. And they said, their conclusion, and it's copied directly from the report, is that they support the standards that the Oregon Department of Revenue has, that is the four-point test. They support that. Now, they had asked the Bureau of Licenses to pursue that, and but it was a recommendation. You study it, pursue it, and so that is an issue that might come up. Already, I think the ground has been covered. At least by these fine people, and certainly I am in agreement with the four-factor test for a couple of reasons. One, it's perhaps fair, and that's opinion, but secondly, it's something that every business in Oregon is doing anyway, aren't they? Because they have to file a tax return for the state. So now the last issue, finally, and you've been very patient with me, and I appreciate it, is the fact that you might hear, well, gosh, you know, this puts us in some unknown waters, uncharted waters, and we don't have time to do this. You know, we have next year is coming up. We have to print our new tax forms pretty soon. And so I'd like to comment on this. First of all, I've noticed that this Bureau can move real quickly when it wants to. And they can muster their forces and get things done. Now, what they're going to have to do is figure out what is the impact of the four-factor test. Because it might result in a gain or a loss in revenues. And then between now and the next tax reporting period, what they would do is determine what is the impact of the four-factor test. And then if they chose to, they could adjust the tax rate. Remember the 3.65% tax rate? They could adjust that up or down. Such that this thing is revenue neutral. Because remember, there's no more owner's compensation if you buy into this deduction limit, if you buy into this. So there will have to be adjustment to the rate anyway to balance the playing field, because it will have to balance. If the small employer only has to pay his fair share, that means the large employer is going to pay more. So there is a balancing of the playing field. That is done by adjusting this rate, the 3.65% rate. So, but there's another factor, and as I mentioned, that's this 4-factor test. I think they can do that by the time, by next year, I think they can do that and have the right rate in time to publish what rate that they want to use. And I think, and I hope, I'll just say I hope, because I don't know, please understand, I do not know, but I hope that the Oregon Department of Revenue will assist the county and the city in determining what is the consequence of changing from the single-factor test to the four-factor test. And I thank you again so much for your courtesy and for your attention. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them, Chairman.
Questions for Mr. Butler. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Butler, isn't it true that the owner's compensation exceeding $53,000 that gets rolled back into business income would not be taxed as business income by the federal government or by the state of Oregon?
That's certainly my understanding, is that that is a deduction. Of course, if a tax filer couldn't justify, you know, that it was a reasonable deduction, then of course that would be disallowed by an audit process. But yes, that's my understanding, that labor is deductible, even if it's an owner that has been paid the compensation for work, both federal and state. In fact, in every state, I hope you don't mind me just hope not over-answering, I don't know of anywhere else in the country, and nobody else does either, where this kind of deduction is disallowed.
Thank you.
Representative Bates.
You know, you mentioned the four-factor tax. If the state were to change that to a one-factor sales tax, would that affect how you feel about this bill?
No, it doesn't, because, and you hope you don't mind me saying it this way, I really have faith. I really have faith. That kind of a change would be so questioned and thought through that I would support it. It would not occur frivolously. And if it were good for the state of Oregon, I would say it was good for every local government in the state.
Thank you very much, Mr. Butler. Let's bring up the Portland team. I'll just kind of move these things back and forth. Marge Kafori, Terry Williams, and Dave Boyer of Multnomah County. Marge, you don't want to come up?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Marge Kafori, Government Relations Director, City of Portland. I really didn't have a speaking role this afternoon, but I'd be happy to introduce the other people who are here. Terry Williams is the manager of the business license program for the City of Portland. Dave Boyer is the budget director for Multnomah County.
Whichever one of you wants to proceed, please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Chair Setterly and members of this committee. My name is Terry Williams. I'm the operations and policy manager for the Bureau of Licenses, City of Portland. Portland has had a business license since 1861. Previous to 1975, gross receipts was used to calculate what the fee would do was. In 1975, under Mayor Neil Goldschmidt, the business community was involved in reviewing the business license law and determined that a net income-based license fee was a more equitable way for businesses to contribute their fair share to support Portland services. There has been periodic reviews of the business license. Mr. Butler did refer to one of the more recent ones in 1990. The committee, that whenever we ask a committee to review the license, we ask them to be particularly concerned with balancing equity, revenue neutrality, and sound tax theory when they recommend changes. The City of Portland is opposed to this bill. This bill takes away the authority of local government leaders, citizens, and business representatives to shape a tax structure that generally conforms to state tax laws and supports local priorities. And we do believe that one such priority for Portland is the support of small local businesses. This bill requires the city to use allocation and apportionment rules as defined in state statutes. One such rule is known as throwback. Currently, the City of Portland nor Multnomah County uses throwback in computing sales that are attributable to Portland. If we were required to do this, this would increase what a business would have to pay to Portland. Multiple factors, which is what the state uses, can potentially also disadvantage local businesses to multinational businesses that have nexus in lots of places outside. Therefore, they have a small amount of payroll and property here and sales, and they'll get to reduce that apportionment. So it does impact local businesses if we go to that type of an apportionment structure. This bill also prohibits Portland or any other local jurisdiction from making any modifications to taxable income. We currently allow a deduction on a sole proprietor return, as an example, for one half of self-employment taxes paid. It would no longer be allowed under this bill. Additionally, we allow a deduction for IRAs and other non-discriminatory retirement plan contributions. Again, not allowed under this bill. Business entity choices, such as operating as a sole proprietor or a partnership or a corporation, can dictate how the business both determines income and who's responsible for reporting it. In an attempt to create a level playing field between sole proprietors, partnerships, and corporations, both the city and county limited the compensation paid to owners. The city and county believe that this method was a reasonable way to treat similarly situated businesses equitably and remove the impact of an entity choice. The federal and state governments do not tax the partnership or the S corporation, but allow the income to be passed through, or losses in some cases, to be passed through to the individual partners and shareholders. I believe that this bill would require the city of Portland to assess our tax or fee on each partner and shareholder, resident and non-resident alike, instead of at the partnership or the S corporation level. This will create an administrative burden on the city of Portland, but more importantly, an administrative and financial burden on each individual partner and shareholder who, prior to this, would have no liability to file with us and would now find themselves having to do so. The city and county has very specific rules for net operating losses, and we also believe that this bill would change those. Of course, that's most likely to be to our detriment and not an individual taxpayer's because of carry back and longer carry forward rules. We have done an analysis on the impacts, at least preliminarily. We believe that the city of Portland would lose approximately $10 million. We believe that Multnomah County would lose approximately $9 million in the current taxes. Additionally, we believe that the city of Portland would incur increased administrative costs, approximately $1 million, due to needing to collect from individuals that haven't had to pay us before, partners and shareholders. We believe our account load would increase by over 300%. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Question from Ms. Williams. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Williams, you in your testimony said in 1975 when the city went to this tax methodology that the objective was to tax net income instead of revenue. Isn't that correct?
We went from a gross receipts revenue to a net income. Yes, that's correct.
Okay, but in reality, the way Mr. Butler's business is being taxed, as he explained it, is not based upon his net business income. His wages are being taxed, aren't they?
As I stated, there's differences in how different types of entities can deduct or not deduct certain incomes. That is put into our codes to ensure that somebody who chooses to be a sole proprietorship is treated the same way as somebody who chose to be a corporation.
Okay, but if I can follow up on that, Mr. Chairman, but the effect of it in the example Mr. Butler shared with us is that wages to owners of the business are being taxed as net business income. Isn't that correct?
Representative Witt, if an owner is paid an income and they own, and specifically with a corporation, own more than 5%, then their wages are added back and they're allowed a very specific deduction. So I guess the answer would be part of them is being taxed.
So part of his wages are being taxed as net income?
Yeah.
All right, thank you. Can I follow up, Mr.
You may.
You talked about sole proprietors and corporations, and there's lots of, it would seem to me, lots of factors that a business owner uses to determine if he or she is going to incorporate or not incorporate. What I'd be interested in, though, is your comments on the apparent bias in your tax system between publicly held companies and how they are taxed and smaller companies that are not publicly held, as demonstrated in the example that Mr. Butler showed us. Could you comment about the built-in bias that appears to exist there?
Representative Witt, I guess I won't use the term bias, but a large company or a small company, it doesn't matter if the owner, if there's somebody who owns more than 5%, they have treatment the same way. We've got several Northwest-based companies that have shareholders that earn millions of dollars, and they are treated the same way as a small company. What the difference is the control issue, and that's a little bit of a difference. And so it's not the size that makes that distinction. It's the ownership percentage.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman? It seems to me it is the size, and because clearly I think it's ownership of more than 5% that gets caught into this. Isn't that correct?
In the case of a corporation, yes.
Yes, I'm talking about corporations. I'm concerned here about the bias between small corporations and larger corporations. And I think the example of Louisiana Pacific, which is headquartered, I believe headquartered, or certainly has a large establishment in Portland, none of the employees of that company own more than 5% of the company, I believe. So in that example, and it was similar to the example we looked at. Mm-hmm. Company will have a significant income that's going to be subject to tax, but none of the compensation that was paid to management was subject to any kind of tax. Whereas in the smaller corporation, where typically it's family-owned, you may have a husband and wife, or it may be just be one person, or it may be three or four family members. People are legitimately making $100,000, $150,000, $200,000. And yet these folks in the smaller companies, because they own more than 5%, their wages are getting put back in the income. So that's what I'm concerned about. I'd like to have your comments about that inherent bias that appears to exist there.
Again, it's not the size of the business that does that. It's the ownership, because you can take a number of very large companies based in the Northwest that have gross sales of over $5 billion that have an owner of more than 5% who's maybe paid $1 million. That's a similar treatment as a small company.
If I can follow up, Mr. Chairman. Then let's talk about publicly held companies and closely held companies. Publicly held companies that have tens of thousands of shareholders typically will not run into this situation where you have an employee of the business who owns more than 5% of the business. Whereas in a closely held company, often a big piece of their compensation falls into that, and thus they end up with a much higher, they end up with a lot of wages being imputed into the business income, and thus the ultimate tax on the business incomes ends up being, as in Mr. Butler's example, three times higher. So would you comment upon the apparent bias between publicly held companies with thousands of shareholders and closely held companies?
Again, I'm not sure that I can, because I've got examples of publicly held companies in exactly that same way. And our concern, again, is that's looking at a very narrow piece, and making a change for that does have an impact on everybody else, the sole proprietors and the partnerships that cannot pay themselves wages, and their whole bottom line is potentially taxed because they are not, based on federal law, allowed to pay themselves a salary and therefore deduct it. I guess that's where the city and the county's historical concern has been.
One last follow-up,
sure.
Mr. Chairman. Okay, well, again, I would point out I was talking about the apparent bias between smaller corporations, closely held and publicly held. You talked about revenue losses here, but in reality, this bill doesn't have to cost the city or the county any revenue loss, because isn't it true all the city or county would have to do would adjust their rate of tax, and that right now, in the example Mr. Butler had, there's a hidden tax that by clearing this up, city would have to make explicit by adjusting its rate, possibly. Isn't that true? So this doesn't have to cost the city any money. It's a matter of setting the tax rate to bring in the revenue the city needs, isn't it?
Representative Witt, yes, the city could, of course, increase the rate. The rate increase required to obtain over $10 million to replace it is a significant increase. It would more than double the rate. Mm-hmm. And whether that's feasible or reasonable for the rest of the business, I mean, that's a good question.
But those dollars are already being paid, aren't they? You say double the rate. The dollars are already coming. The $10 million you'd have to make up, you're already getting. So you're really not increasing the rate. You're just redistributing it.
If what I understood you to say was to ask me if we'd have to increase the rate
yes.
to do that. So, yes, we would. That would have an ultimate shift because of these other rules that have
right.
gone in. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Boyer.
Good afternoon, Chair Shetterly and members of the committee. My name is Dave Boyer. I'm Finance Director of Multnomah County. I'm not going to go over all the technical aspects. Multnomah County adopted its income tax in 1976, and it was administered by the state of Oregon until 1993, when we entered into an agreement with the city of Portland to have them administer our tax. And that was a result of this study in 1992 that the city and county went under, where we had the business community involved. They looked at both of our tax codes. We made numerous changes to our tax code so that we would be alike, so it was easier for businesses in the Multnomah County, Portland area to administer. We had the joint administration, so we are not duplicating administrative services. We contract with the city of Portland. And we have worked very hard, and we worked with the community to get a tax that we thought was fair to the community. And we had business people on that committee that helped us define those tax codes, and we're very proud that we have done that. We also think that This is a local control. Our commissioners have to balance the taxes within Multnomah County boundaries to meet the needs of the whole community. So they listened to those and listened to the business community as we went through this. And in fact, when we did adopt the different changes, Multnomah County reduced our rate so it was revenue neutral in 1993. So, I mean, our tax rate went down as a result of this to make sure that the county was not bearing any gains during the transition. And again, we would be losing approximately $9 million in lost revenues if this was enacted, and it would be a shift. We'd have to increase our tax rate to make up any lost revenues.
Let me ask Mr. Boyer and Ms. Williams, when you talk your revenue loss, $10 million, $9 million, we think biennially here, are you talking annually?
We're talking annually.
Annual.
Questions for Mr. Boyer? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boyer, do you think it would have been appropriate back in 1975 or 1976 to index this $50,000 for inflation?
This was brought to our attention in 1992, and we have started indexing that after it was brought to our attention. So we feel that it was at the time. The revenue loss was very great, so we started indexing in, I think it was 1999 when we took this back and changed the code. So it is, we have begun indexing that compensation.
My question was a little bit different. Do you think it would have been appropriate and fair to index it back in 1976 when the tax was enacted?
Yeah.
You came to that conclusion, it sounds like, in 1999.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, 23 years went by.
I would say if I was enacting one, I would have it indexed, but it was not indexed, and the revenue loss was just too great in 1995 when we studied it.
Mr. Chairman, don't we have a revenue impact here from legislative revenue?
I don't.
Did you do a revenue impact on this, a local revenue impact?
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, I didn't generate an independent estimate yet. I don't have the data to do a good job of it. At time, I can pursue that if the committee would prefer.
Yeah, I wonder, Mr. Chairman, if the city, when they looked at the revenue impact of them, was considering the other changes that this compliance with state statute would bring in, not simply looking at going to a flat 3.65 and not being able to infuse wages back in.
But the offsetting
right.
changes.
Yes, in fact, we did in our preliminary analysis. We took in both the apportionment information. We took in the owner's compensation information. We did not deal with the changes to the net operating loss because that would take some substantial research to determine that.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if we can get a copy of that, if the city would provide that to us.
We can get Ed and let Ed run the numbers, too.
That would be fine, yeah.
All right, any other questions? We need to move along here. We've got a few more witnesses to testify. Thank you very much for your testimony today, unless there are any other questions. Let me bring up, we'll try it three at a time here. Is it Chuck Martin, Jason Williams, and Mark Falling? I think I've got that right. I hope so. And you can look for the honor of going first.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Martin. I live at 944 Southeast Selwood Boulevard. I'm testifying today as a private citizen as I am retired. It's a pleasure to be here and see you at work along with my representative Beck. From 1995 to 1997, I was president of the Alliance of Portland Neighborhood Business Associations, which was a umbrella organization for the 34 business associations that operate within the city of Portland. And during that time that I was president of that alliance, it came to our attention the inequities of this method of taxation used by the city and county. So we constituted a group to study the matter extensively. And upon deciding that it was something that we were unanimously opposed to, we worked very hard with lobbying the city council and the county commissioners to change the system to something that would be more equitable. The results of our efforts were totally unsuccessful. Our analysis showed that the system not only discriminates against small business, but it also discriminates against service providers as opposed to product providers, because the service providers have a very difficult time apportioning any of the revenue outside of Multnomah County, whereas those in the wholesale and manufacturing business who are selling over wide areas, often even internationally, can apportion most, if not all, their business income outside of the city, as did my business, which I owned. So I paid almost no tax at all. But those people that I knew that were in the service business, whether it be repairing electric motors or providing accounting services, got stuck because there was absolute nexus to the work they did. So there's a very specific group. It's not only small businesses, but anybody that's providing services. As a matter of fact, we asked several CPA firms to review this to help us with our analysis, and CPAs often prepare the forms that Mr. Butler showed you, and they dutifully prepare the forms. They go to the corporations, they cut a check, the president signs it and sends it off to the city and the county. When we pointed out to the principals of the CPA firms that they were being also discriminated against by the method of taxation on their own business, so they were aghast to find out how it was done. They've been dutifully following the rules, but they haven't given much thought to how it was done in their own, as it impacted their own firms. The city and county, when we were talking to them and lobbying them, never argued that the system was fair. That's never been an issue. The system they started in 1976 is patently unfair. What they argued was that they couldn't afford to lose the revenue. Revenues, we know, is sort of like the opiate of bureaucracy, is once you get it coming in, it's really hard to consider giving it up. We went to the Portland Chamber of Commerce and asked them to swing in on their support, being another large Portland business organization representing businesses. And the Portland Chamber of Commerce is absolutely in paranoia on this because their largest members that pay the largest fees to the chamber are concerned because they are not impacted as heavily by this as are the small businesses. And they are concerned that if the city were to correct this inequity, that the rates would have to go up and therefore they would have to pay more. So the Chamber of Commerce takes no position on this at all. I talked to their president last night. This hasn't started a revolution. It didn't start a revolution in 1976 because most business owners do not understand how this tax is calculated. And it took quite a bit of research. It's a little bit obscure. It's not a tax that you spend a lot of time studying as a businessman. You're much more familiar with state and federal taxation. And you assume that your city taxes will be keyed to the same kind of income test standards as your state and federal returns. So the Alliance continues to oppose this today. In conclusion, this business methodology is unfair to both small and small businesses and to service businesses particularly, and it is growing more unfair even every year, even though they are now beginning to index. Imagine going from $50,000 to $53,000. Wow, it started at $53,000 in 1976. This is crazy. I ask you to move this bill out with a due pass. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Martin, anybody? Okay. Jason Williams.
Yes, Chair Shuttle, members of the committee, Jason Williams, Executive Director of the Taxpayer Association. Thank you for having me here today. I'll be very brief, as always. We're trying to address a problem that we're seeing in the Portland business community where they feel like there's a small business owner's penalty, where if you're an owner, you own your company, there's a penalty that applies to you in this tax. And this tax is growing. We've heard about other counties that are thinking about joining on. Even in this county, in this city, is thinking about last November, they voted on it. And so you're seeing that it is becoming an idea. There's probably people drafting legislation as we speak. So it would be good to have a bill that provides a model for which to base their income taxes off of that does not discriminate, that does not have a small business owner's penalty. You know, with all things being equal, if you had a restaurant right across the street from another restaurant, and one was a mom-and-pop restaurant and the other one was a chain store, or let's say it was a convenience store, and the other one was a mom-and-pop convenience store, well, under this system, that mom-and-pop store pays more in taxes because it's a penalty against them. So when you look at that and you're sitting there thinking, here are two same stores, but just because the person owns it, they have to pay more taxes. And I think that kind of goes against the grain of a lot of things that that the people want in terms of business policy. When we talk about ownership, those people that own most of the companies, they're the small business. They're the Oregon homegrown companies. They're the family-owned companies. And they're also the startups here. And these are the people that should not be getting the brunt end of the burden, the tax burden. And these aren't the companies that aren't like Columbia Sportswear, which can just pick up and move to another county. And there are a lot of companies that I hear more and more that are just getting out of Portland and Multnomah County because they can't stand the taxes and the regulation. They're going over to Washington County. When you're a mom-and-pop store, you can't do that. If you have a restaurant, you just can't move your client base to all the way across town. So that's what we want you to hopefully address here, that there is a small business owner penalty. You've seen some of the numbers, and with this bill, 2279, we hope that you support it because this is the right step forward. Thank you.
Let me ask, we got equities going every which way here, don't we? Let's take the mom and pop. One store is a corporation and one store is a partnership. Just help me through this. If we make this change, we've got two stores, and for whatever reason, one's incorporated. Now, granted, there are lots of reasons to choose a business entity type, but you've got a situation now where we're focusing on this tax liability. In one case, the corporate mom and pop have drawn down, not beyond a reasonable test, but they've drawn down the salaries to either zero out their income or nearly zero out their income. And so then for the purpose of the Portland business license, it's either zero or very small. Across the street, the other mom and pop is an LLC or a partnership or a sole proprietorship. Because of the way the income tax code treats that income, they're paying on their on the total income of the business, or basically the income that goes over their Schedule C, I suppose, or K-1, wherever they file that. Don't they have an equity argument then against the corporate mom and pop store across the street?
Chair Shuttle and members of the committee, there's a lot of scenarios.
Okay,
yes.
Just seem to go every way.
Yeah, and with a lot of mom and pops, they choose to pay out, just with wages their profit, and that would mean that they would miss mostly of the entire business tax. Of course, that takes them into a payroll tax, which Oregon happens to have one of the highest payroll taxes in the country. It's there's a natural disproportionation to any tax that you have. If you have a personal property tax, it affects businesses that have a lot of property than those that don't. And in a strict business tax, there will be sort of a natural proportionality. But I think what Multnomah County and the city have done as in trying to fix it have gone too far the other way and have created sort of a small business owner penalty.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I mean, I would just reiterate that there are lots of decisions, lots of factors go into making a decision to incorporate or not to incorporate. But what I think is happening here is the city of Portland's process is it's taking corporations and it's creating this inequity on smaller, closely held corporations. And, that's the bias I'm concerned about. I mean, the issue to incorporate or not incorporate, of course, involves lots of things. And I don't know that it's, the city's suggesting that should be part of the balance here. I don't see it. Because I mean that's a completely different decision. It's based upon different criteria.
I just want to make sure if we're getting into it, we're going to make it better and not just make it bad in a different way. That's my concern as I try and sort my way through this. Because this seems to be an issue really between small corporations and large corporations as much as anything, publicly traded corporations. We make the change in one way, and it seems to me we've just created a different kind of inequity, unless we wade into the whole thing and recreate the Portland and Multnomah business license and income tax. I don't have the stomach for that.
Mr. Chairman, this bill is meant, of course, to address one specific inequity, but if I can ask Mr. Williams a question.
Yeah.
You brought up an interesting example here. You talked about, I think, a restaurant or a store. If you use the example, an Applebee's, which is a publicly held company, or another national restaurant chain, they could have a manager working in their business at one of their stores who's making $90,000 a year, a locally owned business where the owner owns the business, maybe a man and his wife, they own the business. They might be paying themselves $90,000 a year. But clearly, you see the inequity here that $40,000 of the income of the second company, which is locally owned, would be taxed as business income, where none of the Applebee's wages to employees would be taxed as business income. Isn't that what your testimony was referring to?
Exactly. And, you know, with a mom-and-pop store, you've got a chain stores like 7-Eleven compared to a mini-mart across the street. You know, if that 7-Eleven was publicly owned, there is a penalty there.
Okay. Mr. Hawley.
Thank you, Chairman Shetterly and the distinguished members of the committee. I am here basically representing small business. I'm
small incorporated business.
Small incorporated business, yeah. I am Marcus Holling, United Finance Company. I'm Executive Vice President for United Finance Company. I'm also a CPA, and probably my background is probably one to speak specifically to this. Back in my early years in accounting, 25 years ago, I was also a City of Portland Business License Auditor. I know the City of Portland Business License from back then, and am familiar with it. And back then, believe me, I tried really hard, and I was a good auditor and went out and did my best to audit the city business license and left there as different promotions in the city took me to other places, and then I decided to leave the city and became a CPA. So I have a special perspective from how the forms are filled out as a business, small business owner, as I am a part owner in this corporation, and from how the license is administered. Now, the city business license and the Multnomah County business income tax is a tax. I mean, it's based upon income, and that is really important. I don't think there's anybody that's questioning that, but it is based upon income. And that's apportioned to Portland. And that, as that apportionment goes, there are many different ways of apportioning money in or out, and it impacts different services or businesses differently. I know of one of my competitors that within the past month has just moved out of the city of Portland from Multnomah County into Clackamas County for this very reason, is the inequities there is they were able to save over $25,000 a year just by moving across the county line, which was 10 more minutes down the road from their old location. And their sole decision to do this was because of the inequities that are there in the city and the county taxes. This business income tax, and it specifically restricts the deduction of salaries. And that is the key point here, is that it does specifically restrict that deduction. And it hits the person that makes the decision whether they should be in Portland or not. Because as the owner, you're the one that says, well, I'll stay in Portland or I'm going to move. And then you turn right back around and tell that owner that, no, your time, your talents, your effort is only worth $53,000 in the current year.
Mr. Ron?
Yes.
Let me just ask that. This is an interesting discussion. I guess, let me ask, and I don't mean this to sound as facetious as a sense, why do we care whether someone locates in Multnomah County or Clackamas County? That seems to me a lot more something of interest to Multnomah County than it does to the state legislature.
That's correct. What we have right now is an opportunity to clear up some problems that could be going down the road too. There is an inequity here. But down the road, what happens if City of Milwaukee or Clackamas County develop a similar license fee, and they use a different methodology, still income-based, but a different methodology to determine that? So now we have a methodology in Multnomah County, a methodology in Clackamas County, a methodology potentially in Washington County.
Well, eventually we'll move these businesses down to Polk County. That'd be great.
we have offices in Multnomah County and Clackamas County and Washington County, up and down the valley, of 20 locations in Oregon. And so we're pretty well spread throughout Oregon. Now, I'm concerned that, you know, what if every county, every city or whatever that we're in, if Eugene, Lane County decides they're going to do the same thing, and they come up with a special rule. I'd like to see some uniformity in it, some uniformity in how it's computed, some uniformity in a basis that will give us a basis of operation, and not just have every local jurisdiction kind of willy-nilly say, okay, you get a $50,000 deduction, you get a $125,000 deduction, you get no deduction, or you get everything, and pretty soon, you know, it's really hard to manage. As I indicated when I audited, that was one of the areas that was hard to explain to the owner of the business is why their time and talent was only worth $50,000, and it was much less back then because I was auditing it was back to $25,000. But it, you know, it's worth $53,000 now, and they have many of their employees that are earning much more than $53,000, yet they only get to claim the $53,000. So there is that phantom tax that's there. And I want to just point out, too, that this is a specific tax that is on small businesses. Ms. Williams also in her testimony said that there was that there'd be a revenue shortfall of $19 million. And to my point, my thinking, well, that's $19 million that is being extracted out of small business that should be equitably paid by everyone, large business and small business. And if the rates have to go up for big business, then the rates probably should go up for big business so that everybody pays their fair share for doing business in Portland. And I think this House bill is one that can bring that equity to it.
Okay. Thank you. Interesting discussion. Any questions for the gentleman? Well, if not, then Michelle Deister, we'll bring you up for your 30 seconds. I'm sorry. You're our last witness.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities, and I would just like to point out that Section 2, Subsection 3 of the bill talks about license fees on or measured by income, and we have some concerns this could possibly be interpreted to pertain to municipal franchise fees that are imposed on utilities and telecommunications companies, et cetera. And obviously, we're very concerned about that possibility. You know, perhaps I'm wrong here, but I just wanted to point that out. And just make the point that since the passage of Measure 5 and 50, franchise fees are the second largest source of revenue for many cities after property taxes. And they provide a reliable and stable source of funding for municipal services. In many cases, especially telecommunications, the franchise fee statutes have been agreed to over time with the parties, and it seems that changing the basis of this fee through this legislation would be unnecessary, especially considering that that conversation is probably going to be had in the context of other bills. And that's really all I wanted to point out. So.
Mr. Representative Witt, yes.
Franchise fees are based upon revenues. It's a percentage of the revenue of the telecommunications carrier, not their net income.
Okay.
So. Representative Bates.
Well, I'm fairly convinced that this is looking at a significant equity in what's going on in Portland and Multnomah County. I'm concerned that this is a local issue and we're trying to fix it on the state level. My question to you is, would you go back to your constituency and find out if this would have unintended consequences for the cities in the state, besides what you just mentioned, which may not be a significant factor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I do know that the city of Roseburg imposes a fee based upon gross revenues in its downtown district, so that is another city that may be affected. But I don't know exactly how that is applied and whether or not the situation is analogous, you know, in terms of the methodology that's used to calculate that. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, there's an easy solution. That's that they adopt your tax bill, and it,
yes, it is.
Well, it solves all the problems.
Right. Solves all the problems. So let's keep that in mind. Okay, thank you, everybody, for a very interesting hearing. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2279, and we're adjourned.